This weekend, in parades across the nation, Irish Americans are strutting their stuff, decked out in plastic green derbies and waving four-leaf clover flags. In New York yesterday, more than 150,000 marchers celebrated St. Patrick's Day, along with a crowd pushing 2 million. But producer Adam Phillips looked beyond the rabble-rousers on Fifth Avenue, as he recently took a trip to Ireland in search of the true nature of Irishness.
Every green-blooded American knows that today is St. Patrick's Day. And most people are aware that St. Patrick is credited with driving the snakes from Ireland when he Christianized the island back in the 5th century. What is lesser known is that back in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day is no big deal.
St. Patrick's Day is on a most inappropriate time for us. It's usually raining out of the heavens, it's wet, it's dreary, it's cold. And most people in Ireland spend St. Patrick's Day, you know, watching TV, waiting for the New York parade to come on TV. And that's a fact, simply because it doesn't fit in with our agrarian calendar.
Phil Shepherd sits at the long wooden bar at McGorty's, a little family-run pub in the village of Drumshambo, County Leitrim, heart of Ireland. He hand rolls a cigarette, takes a sip of Guinness, and begins to hold forth on what being Irish is all about, deep down. A complicated subject, but it's raining out, what the Irish call a soft day, and he's got time. Shepherd explains that while St. Patrick did Christianize the island, many of the old pagan ideas are still very much alive in the Irish psyche, and an implicit belief in what they call the other side is one of these.
Celtic pagan belief is in the very marrow of every Irish person, so much so that they're unaware of it. You could have a PhD in nuclear physics, and you may not be a superstitious person, but you won't knock the guy that is, because you understand it. It's part of what you are. It's at the very, very, very heart of Irishness. And lots of people nowadays are completely unaware of it. Lots of younger kids coming on completely dismiss it as a pishogue, as nonsense.
Who are we to say that there isn't another world around us? I don't have any doubts at all. People will tell you it's imagination, but the point is, what is imagination? So.
In the west of Ireland, it's not hard to find people who commune in one way or another with some hidden world where wood sprites and fairies and little folk are said to live. But these people aren't just pie-in-the-sky mystics. This woman, for example, is a judge, and she was 12 years old when this experience happened.
It was a beautiful summer's morning, and we came to a place that is called the Gee. It was an inlet of the sea, and I stood for a while, and all of a sudden, I saw this little man, tiny, maybe 2 feet about tall, you know, but an old little man. He had a little brown hat and a little brown waistcoat, and he had a bucket and a spade, and he stared up at me, and I stood looking down at him, and he didn't speak and I didn't speak, and I started getting afraid. I turned back then up through the fields towards my own home. It was strange. We stared at one another.
Eight-year-old Naomi Rogers has brilliant red hair and lives in rural County Sligo. When asked if she had ever seen any fairies, it was obvious that she had no need for the four-leaf clover ointment Irish poets once used to help give them the fairy sight.
I've seen them directly, blinking like bits of dark light. It's like you're sleeping. You're in kind of a daze when you go through all the worlds.
Naomi has a solid hour's worth of expertise to relate about Irish fairies. But first, she wants to set straight a tiresome stereotype.
They don't wear, like, pretty dresses and ball gowns like most children believe. They wear old shaggy dresses and things.
When asked for a quick primer on the different sorts of fairies, Naomi recites a list.
One for wood, one for trees, one for leaves, one for everything. Don't you see thousands of little sparks when you put something into the fire? Well, they're fire fairies. Some fairies are not nice at all, like the drowning fairy. She has like a skeleton head, and she's all green. If you had your back to a pool or maybe the edge of a sea, sometimes she crawls out of there and drowns you.
Kids aren't the only ones who believe in fairies in Ireland. For example, when building an addition onto a house, care is routinely taken not to cover one of the ancient fairy pathways. Also, it's bad luck to cut down a low thorn bush. These are considered sacred to the fairies. And this is, in fact, what locals say accounts for the downfall of automaker John DeLorean, who cut a fairy bush when he was building his factory. Ireland is dotted throughout with gently rounded grassy mounds, often with specially placed circles of stones. Archaeologists take these to be Neolithic burial sites, but country folks see them as fairy rings and forts, and avoid them on pain of disaster. These beliefs are not limited to the countryside. They can have very expensive practical effects in the cities as well. Tom Kenny is a prominent bookseller from Galway City, the capital of the Gaelic-speaking West Coast.
Recently, there was a major site sold in Galway for development as housing. But there is still one very interesting green area left in the middle of the housing development, which is an old fairy ring or a fairy fort. It intrigued me that the superstition among the urban manual labourers was so strong that they wouldn't go near it with their JCBs or their machinery, that they were convinced that some kinds of strange curses would be rained down on them if they did.
Even in Dublin, the cosmopolitan capital of the Irish Republic, country ways are just beneath the surface. For example, when flying low over the city, one is struck by the elaborate roof garden plots, some only 3 feet by three. Just like the small potato plots and pasture land of the countryside, these plots are often encircled by stones, and their stewards assert a fierce proprietary interest in their upkeep. Nowhere is the Irish tie to the land and sea more poignantly expressed than in the Seanós, literally old way singing tradition, a form that is still popular in the remote windswept regions of Ireland where Gaelic is still an everyday language. Many say that Seanós is unequaled in its expressive powers and its poetry, and that it alone can convey the strongest sense of what it means to be Irish. That's Sean McDonough, singing for his wife, Breed. When he sings, McDonough has a look of intense concentration, hands on temples, eyes closed. Breed rocks back and forth and watches him with an inward smile.
There's so much music in that. In one line, their eyes close and they're just away from everybody. I wonder if it's paradise for them. They're so happy and so relaxed.
People who sing Seanós songs claim a deep spiritual nourishment from doing so. But harsh historical realities have caused the tradition to flourish as well. This fact helps to explain the melancholy tinge one often hears in the music. Conall O'Donnell is an old Donegal man and one of the guiding spirits behind a contest and gathering for Seanós called an Oireachtas.
There were a time when England took power and ruled Ireland, and they chased the people from the Midlands, where the rich soil was, to the cliffs and the rocks and the islands of the sea. But yet they were so gifted in fiddle playing and music and dancing and composing songs and in singing. We have a storage of tradition, and we value that.
Seanós songs are full of the lore of daily life, and include stories about matchmaking, heroic exploits, boating wrecks, and good love gone bad. Seanós songs are almost always sung in Gaelic, the language the Irish simply call Irish, a language they have long been ambivalent about. Brendan O'Hare, one of Ireland's leading journalists and a native Gaelic speaker, puts it plainly.
A lot of Irish people would be very, very grateful if the Irish language did them a favour and died, so that they wouldn't have to make up their minds about what to do with it. While it's still there, they have to make up their minds whether they are going to learn it themselves, whether they're going to see to it that their children learn it, or what.
Gaelic Irish is a highly colourful Indo-European language with roots in Persia, and has been spoken in one form or another for well over 2,000 years. It is said to be extremely difficult to learn. In modern times, Gaelic has come to be associated with the poverty and the social isolation of the colonial days. And since Irish independence in 1922, Gaelic has come to be seen by many as an old-fashioned extravagance, almost like an old-world language within its own country. Still, in pockets around the country, it is holding on fairly well. Nan Flaherty is a grandmother in her 80s with perfect wrinkles. I visit her at her home in the village of Spittle, County Galway.
It's a lovely language, and I'm proud of my heritage and my language. Tarimit moram as mahanga, as myriacht.
What does that mean?
I'm proud out of my language, for having it, and my originality.
So you must feel really good to see all these kids beginning to speak it again. And
I'm afraid the kids are letting it go. They're speaking English, you know, whereas I didn't have any English when I was going to school. Not a word. And I hope you'll come back and learn Irish to this country, and I'll teach you some Irish.
You will?
I will.
Okay. How do you say thank you in Irish?
Gura mahagat.
Gura mahagat.
There you are. You can say it exactly the way I said it. Gura
mahagat. Here at the two-room Dunquin School in County Kerry, class is always conducted in Gaelic. Three children at the school tell how recent Irish history has played a role in their desire to keep the language alive.
When my great-great-grandfather was alive, he got whipped at school for speaking Irish because it was against the law to speak it.
France and Spain are proud of their language and they're not ashamed to speak it. Some people in Ireland are.
You know, I like, you know, two languages, but I prefer the Irish.
Garroy Denver is an Irish professor who grew up in an English-speaking home in Dublin. Yet he felt deeply drawn to Gaelic from the moment he heard it. He draws a distinction between a mother language and a native one.
A mother language, to me, is the language spoken to a child by her or his parents. Native language, to me, is on the level of communal experience. The Irish continuum is 2,000 years old and unbroken, battered and torn on many occasions, but still there.
Nowhere is deep Irish culture more visible than in the pubs, which are frequently the scene of jam sessions. Simon O'Dwyer is a musician who loves Ireland and says that its culture has something gentle and important to teach.
For my money, the good points of Irish culture are well worth expounding to the world. Openness would be the basic one. Trust, the ability to have a good time, or as we say in Ireland, to have the crack.
And O'Dwyer likes to connect the best of Ireland's present with its past, something that comes easily to him when he joins in on a session.
Let's say you're first to arrive. You go and you sit down in the area. The next thing, all the boys arrive in. There might be 5, 6, 7, 10 musicians arrive in. Automatically, they'll form a circle. And if the circle is closed and you come in, then it'll open and it'll make a space for you and you go in, you know. And what made me think about is what was the stone circles all over Ireland, going back, what, 4,000 or 5,000 years. And if you look at a stone circle, there might be, say, 15 stones, and you could very easily just put a musician at every one of those stones. And it'd be what's happening today in the pub. It's like a fountain, the power of it. They've all got the hand in the central pool, you know, and they're all clicking away together. Now, how's that for a collective memory?
For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Phillips.